You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Quitándole lo seco.
Lourdes Valdovinos has a green thumb.
Una planta.
An array of fruit trees surrounds her home on Percy Street in East Los Angeles. Guava and pitaya, or dragon fruit. There are flowers and herbs that shroud the facade of this single-story house where she lives with her husband, her kids, and her grandchildren. The backyard? Yeah, it looks like some kind of community farm.
Y aquí tenemos, mira, todo esto son piñas.
Yeah, she even has pineapples sprouting up like a tropical plantation. But most of the stuff is growing in black plastic pots above ground. And that's because Valdovinos lives near Exide. The company owned and operated a lead-acid battery recycling plant for decades, contaminating parks and restaurants and schools and thousands of homes. Now, the Exide plant has been closed since 2015, and the company was paying to clean up the soil around houses just like this one. Until now, a federal judge recently approved a company bankruptcy plan. And as KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb tells us, that legal decision has imperiled the cleanup effort.
If you spend a day in this part of East Los Angeles, you'll hear a lot of this. From the small Bobcat loader carrying brand new soil into the backyard of a single-family home, to the construction worker spraying water from a hose to keep the dust at bay, to the pollution monitor that chirps when things get dangerous. This neighborhood, sandwiched between the arms of the 5 and the 60 freeways, is dangerous. There's lead in the soil from the Exide plants, which can cause a host of health problems, from anemia to birth defects to lower IQ in kids. Guadalupe Valdovinos, whose mother you just heard from earlier, says Exide victimized her working-class Latino community.
Clearly, this is environmental racism. We are just collateral damage. We don't have access to anything. Some of our community members don't even have health care. So if they come across any lead poisoning, who's going to pay for that?
Mis dos gatos que yo tenía murieron de cáncer. En mi familia no hay cáncer.
Her mother, Lourdes Valdovinos, says her two cats died of cancer, and she didn't really know why. And then she got cancer herself, kidney cancer, even though she doesn't have any family history of the stuff. And it's not just her.
Aquí hay muchos neighbors que han salido con cáncer, bastantes.
She says a lot of her neighbors and their pets have also developed cancer. She blames Exide, and lead has been linked to cancer. There are even lawsuits about it. The state of California has identified about 8,000 properties within a roughly 2-mile radius of Exide that need to be cleaned up, from East LA to Bell and Maywood. So far, the State Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC for short, says it's done about 1/4 of the cleanup, including the Valdovinos' home, which had its soil replaced a couple years ago. But there are still thousands of more properties to go. And now there is a big question mark hanging over how all of this will be paid for. A federal judge last month approved an Exide bankruptcy plan that calls for the state to cover the rest of the cost, about $650 million right now. Meredith Williams heads up the California DTSC.
All along, we had been expecting to pursue Exide for cost recovery, but you're absolutely right. These cleanups are expensive, and it's unconscionable that right now the state is on the hook for the cleanup.
And that means the taxpayers will likely be responsible for cleaning these homes. Now, Exide did not respond to requests for comment from KCRW, but in the past, the company has claimed it's not responsible for lead contamination outside the confines of its plant in Vernon, which it took over about 2 decades ago. Instead, other sources are to blame, the company says, from lead paint on houses to other industrial facilities nearby. But residents just don't buy it. They've complained for decades about what they call the health risks caused by Exide's plant. Now, the bankruptcy plan has once again brought protesters to the streets demanding more resources for this cleanup.
When is the land under attack? What do we do?
The frustration extends beyond Exide, though. If you ask community activists like Mark Lopez, the state is culpable too. He and other activists with the nonprofit East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice have been leading demonstrations, like this one, in Boyle Heights the last few months.
We haven't just been fighting Exide, but we've also been fighting the state, because right now the state is looking at an area that is a 1.7 mile radius from Exide. But 99% of the 8,000 homes they've already sampled need to be cleaned up. The levels of lead are so high that they need to be cleaned up. So that tells us that they haven't found the edge.
In other words, the contamination zone identified by the state just is not large enough. In fact, many of the protesters I've met live outside this area and say they've had their soil tested on their own only to find carcinogenic levels of lead. Meredith Williams with DTSC admits California deserves some of the blame for continually renewing this plant's permits despite concerns about pollution, but she prefers to take the long view. While Exide may be the worst example, she says, there are many, many more.
I don't think that there's a good understanding of the magnitude of this type of contamination around the state. We use toxic materials every day. And what are we willing to sacrifice in order to stop the next Exides, in order to divert taxpayer money to clean up these sites? There are tough decisions that need to be made.
Tough decisions about how we live and also where the money will come from for this type of cleanup and what sites will get cleaned first. A state auditor's report last month called for immediately remediating all childcare centers, all parks and schools that are near Exide. And DTSC says it's going to comply with the auditor's recommendations. But back in East LA, Guadalupe Valdovino says she does not feel she has any agency at all. Her home has been cleaned, but she's expecting another child, and she's worried about lead in the air. As we talk in her backyard, construction crews work on her neighbor's house. It's being remodeled, and there is dust flying everywhere.
I used to love being out here, but now I'm just scared, especially because I'm pregnant, and both of my neighbors' properties have not been cleaned, so we're sandwiched in between this constant dust of risk.
Valdovino says she noticed her first daughter had some developmental problems that she associates with lead exposure when she was younger.
She's 11, and she, Dahlia, suffered a little bit of speech delay, so that was also concerning. But I didn't make that connection until 2018, until she was at least 8-9 years old.
Now, she's afraid to leave the back house where she lives, and she cleans obsessively.
So it's scary and it's sad that I have to, my neighbors next door are doing construction, so I have to close my doors, have to close my windows. I can't, if I'm cooking, the smell's gonna stay within the house.
And I can hear, we're outside right now in your backyard, yes. And I can hear the construction, there's scraping,
yeah.
Clearly there's dust flying in the air, and we're literally, I mean, this has gotta be 20 yards from us.
Yes, yes, so the threat is there, it's real. Their property is not going to be cleaned up anytime soon. And then with the bankruptcy that just passed, there might not be any more funds. So we're stuck.
The state of California has said it will foot the bill to finish this cleanup, but the money just isn't allocated. The Valdovinos family worries this means more delays while their family grows. And all the while, lead-filled dust fills the air all around them. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA County has a population of about 10 million people, more than any other county in the United States. In fact, it's twice as many as the second largest county, Cook County in Illinois, which includes the city of Chicago. No wonder the members of the County Board of Supervisors here have been called the Five Little Kings. Except, well, that nickname really doesn't work anymore, because State Senator Holly Mitchell just got voted onto the board, and that means, as you've probably heard, all five supervisors will now be women. And State Senator and Supervisor-elect Holly Mitchell joins us right now. Welcome and congratulations to you.
Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I'm excited about the opportunity to work hard on behalf of the residents of the 2nd Supervisorial District.
I want to dive in, honeymoon aside, because you're going to have a little while to sort of absorb it all and take office in a few weeks. The board is talking again about whether or not to seek a way to fire or remove L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva. If you were on the board today, what would you be advocating for?
Well, during the campaign, there was lots of conversation. Needless to say, residents of LA County are very interested and engaged and have deep concerns about a number of the actions taken by the sheriff, particularly those who live in my community. And so I was very public as a candidate that I supported the assertion that two supervisors made that he resign. And so I, like many of you, will be anxiously watching their proceedings today to see what legal options the board members have to really exert their power and authority over him maintaining that office.
He was elected by the majority of LA County citizens, voters. How do you balance the rights of voters and the priorities of good government?
That's a very fair and appropriate question. And the challenge is that I am hearing from, you know, county residents, many of whom express their concern that they feel they were, if you will, sold a bill of goods when the sheriff presented himself as a candidate. But there's a deep growing concern about his refusal to come before the Oversight Commission, his refusal to allow the Inspector General to have access to information to do his due diligence. You know, when we continue to see headlines about, and I'm sure it's a minority in the Sheriff's Department, but still, when people continue to see headlines about, you know, inappropriate, illicit behavior, gangs who are among the Sheriff's Department, that gives people concern about his priorities, his commitment to true public safety, because I would argue that we don't have public safety when members of the general public don't trust law enforcement. So we have a problem.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because yesterday we had LA County's new district attorney, George Gascon, on. He was elected with the support of the Black Lives Matter movement that really wanted to see Jackie Lacey, his opponent, and the incumbent replaced. That movement has been calling to defund the police. That phrase means obviously different things to different people. What does that phrase mean to you, and what's your position on quote-unquote defunding the police?
You know, it's no question in my mind that we need to demilitarize the police. When I saw the kind of equipment and artillery, if you will, that many law enforcement, you know, had and showed up in recent months at protests, I think that that's really a first step. You know, secondly, the county, the voters have spoken with regard to their overwhelming support of Measure J. And Measure J is going to require that I, as a city member of the Board of Supervisors, really invest and do what every social scientist has said for decades. When you invest in community and social programs and support programs and prevention programs on the front end, it has a direct impact on the outcome of people's lives. And so when I hear the term defund the police, what that says to me is that it's truly a battle cry, if you will, a call for standing up government systems that support people in crisis to prevent people from being system touched in the first place.
I want to switch from public safety to pandemic, because COVID-19 numbers are surging again. We're heading into the winter months when epidemiologists are telling us that things are likely to get worse. What do you think we should be doing? And what should the Board of Supervisors be doing to try and get this county on track to getting this somehow resolved, or at least under control and opened up again?
You know, I'm deeply concerned. I was just elected to represent communities that have been disproportionately impacted both by this public health and this economic pandemic. And so as we enter the fall and winter, as we enter flu season, as we enter the holiday season where people, we've been shut away and shut off from family, friends, and neighbors for months now. And this is the season of coming together and being thankful and fellowship. I'm deeply concerned that people are going to find it more and more difficult to socially distance and not, you know, go to mama's house and for Thanksgiving dinner as a part of your family tradition. And I'm concerned that we very likely will see increasing numbers. And that's problematic because in order for our economy to recover, for people to be able to go back to work and small businesses to reopen and thrive, we have got to reopen our schools. And we can't do that. And parents won't send their kids if we don't have a high level of confidence that they will be safe. This notion of wearing masks, social distancing, and washing your hands has got to be our individual and collective practice to get us through these next several very, very difficult months.
There's one other topic that I think is top of mind for so many people in the county, and that's homelessness. Perhaps the biggest and most difficult topic that the county faces, with tens of thousands of people experiencing homelessness on the streets. Are you bringing any fresh ideas to the board? I mean, you ran for this office. You know that this is probably the issue of our time in LA. What do you say to that very difficult topic?
It is the moral dilemma of our time. And I don't choose to, you know, continue to call a county a city home that doesn't take every action we can under the law to create appropriate spaces and housing for all of our residents. And it's a complex issue because it's not one reason that leads people to be unhoused. And so we have to have equally as complex, diverse responses. I've carried the bills in the legislature to increase the capacity of the use of housing vouchers. Those are federal dollars that we were sending back to the federal government because people couldn't find landlords who were willing to take a housing voucher. LA County is 500,000 housing units short of what our population requires. We've got to continue to build, although it's in my opinion that we can't build fast enough to build our way out of it. I have been working the last several years with Dr. Sharon, the director of LA County's mental health department, looking at the board and care industry. It's an industry that's existed for decades. Six-bed small facilities in neighborhoods that have been closing at record numbers across the state just because of their inability to keep up financially. Tragically, Measure H and HHH didn't allow for those dollars to be used for existing infrastructure. They're only used for new construction. So we've got to figure out ways to shore up the existing infrastructure and facilities that can help keep people off the street.
State Senator Holly Mitchell, the incoming member of the LA County Board of Supervisors who represents or will represent District 2. Senator, thank you. And again, congratulations to you.
I appreciate you very much. And please stay safe.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now for a break from election coverage to take in some art, to appreciate local Angelenos and their work at the biennial Made in LA. Wait, never mind. You can't actually take it in because it only opened yesterday for a media preview. And our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, went to that media preview. And even though the show isn't open to the public, she is here to tell us about it anyway. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
I mean, okay, so it was a media preview. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Places aren't open to be able to see said things in Made in LA. How on earth are we going to do this?
Right. So, okay, before I get to that, this show is so anticipated in the art world and really amongst the LA art community. It's an opportunity to really highlight the emerging artists who live and work in LA and really kind of celebrate them. So it ends up being a sort of who's who of LA's artists. This year, there's 30 artists included, and the work spans performance, photography, sound work, installation. And this is the first time the Hammer has actually split the exhibition between two venues. So there's one show at the Hammer and sort of an echoing show at the Huntington with all the same artists. But, you know, as of today, COVID restrictions are still in place and the museum can't actually open to the public to really welcome the public in to see these exhibitions.
Because of the restrictions in LA County. I know this was supposed to open back in June, Lindsay, but obviously that didn't happen. They did open for previews yesterday, only for the media. You were there.
Yeah.
So I guess if you could, as a service to the people listening to this program, what was it like?
Yeah, it was a very pandemic era preview. It was kind of like textbook pandemic. So there was an hour of remarks earlier in the day via Zoom that I watched at home on my computer. And remarks from Annie Philbin, the Hammer's director, as well as curators of the exhibition, who sort of walked us through some of the main themes of the show. And then we had to sign up for socially distant timed appointments to go see the show in person. And the galleries were pretty much empty. So it felt pretty strange to be sort of wandering around by myself and bumping into just one or two other press people.
You mentioned that some of the media preview was virtual. Will there be other kinds of virtual exhibits that people will be able to see that perhaps, you know, if you can't go there in a socially distant way, you'll at least still be able to see part of this exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, and just to clarify, Steve, nobody can go see the show still. I was able to just as a member of the press. But as far as, adaptations, for instance, the artist Lahia Lewis was going to have a live dance performance in the Biennial, and that has actually been adapted for online viewing. As well as when you're in the museum, there's a sort of little corner where her work was meant to be, and there's a QR code on the wall that you can, you know, put your phone up to, and then you get pulled to the Vimeo of the dance performance video. But frustratingly, I felt like there are several videos in the show that are not yet available online, although I think they're going to be added in the future. You know, there's a ton of really amazing sculpture and painting in the exhibition that at the moment just exists as JPEGs on the Hammer's website. Which, you know, you and I have talked about, Steve, it's not the same thing, right? And there is no public programming yet to be announced. So a lot of these details in terms of adapting still seem to be kind of being worked out. And I don't know if they fully address the elephant in the room that the public is still unable to see the work. And much of the show still is inaccessible to a broader public.
Is there anything, Lindsay, that you can go see vis-a-vis Made in LA?
Actually, yes. So there are a couple of pieces that were sort of designed this way pre-pandemic. So for instance, Khalil Joseph has this work called Black News. And this is actually a news stream that the artist creates with a team of collaborators. And they pull videos from news sources, TikTok videos, social media, just from a variety of sources as a way to sort of portray the Black community. And this stream is, again, not available online, but you can drive to various locations around LA to stream in person at different sites around the city. And similarly, Larry Johnson has work in the museum, but he also has a handful of his artworks that are kind of up on billboards in a few places around the city. So again, you can drive to those, and there are maps available of both of those projects on the Hammer's website.
What does this mean, Lindsay, though, for the artists? I mean, is it that their work has been hanging there since June and will just continue to hang there for weeks or even months to come, but no one's going to be able to see it?
So I've been told that the museum has the first few months of the year cleared for this exhibition to remain up at least, and they're kind of remaining flexible. I do want to say the show itself is pretty exciting, with a lot of really wonderful works, particularly some paintings that really stood out. And I think the curators did a nice job of making the biennial, which, to be honest, can sometimes just feel like a lot of artworks, a lot of artists crammed into a room together. You know, they made it feel cohesive, and each gallery felt like a sort of mini conversation between a few artists in the show. But again, that's the joy of seeing art in person, and you can't really get that from seeing images on a website.
Lindsay Preston Zappas, our art insider and editor-in-chief over at Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, LA's newest city council member, Nithya Raman. How progressives pushed her over the top and what she wants to accomplish or can accomplish on the council. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us how you're feeling these days and subscribe to the podcast, too. Jenna Cagle, Angel Carreras, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Mario Diaz, Phil Richards, Chuck P., Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and your time. Have a great night.